The right to privacy, one person, one vote, the presumption of innocence. As Americans, we think of these freedoms and many more as our constitutional rights, but they can't actually be found in the Constitution. Constitutional scholar Akhil Rita Marr has written a new book, America's Unwritten Constitution, The Precedents and Principles We Live By. The book guides readers through the landmark cases, implicit principles, common practices, and more that make up our unwritten Constitution, showing how the written and unwritten constitutions fit together to form a single system. It's a great pleasure to welcome Akhil Rita Marr to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.
At what point did we as a culture and as a nation become aware of this unwritten Constitution?
I would say from the beginning. We Americans champion at the moment of our revolution an idea of written constitution. So immediately after declaring independence from Britain, various former colonies that become states adopt written constitutions. It's a glorious American practice. Britain famously didn't have a single document that it could point to as pulling together its basic rules and principles and practices. So from the beginning, we have a very American idea of a written constitution. But alongside that, I would say from the very beginning, there was a recognition that our system couldn't be based solely on these written constitutions, that the written constitution would need to be supplemented by various unwritten understandings, practices, precedents. Very early on, for example, the Ninth Amendment is adopted. It's born really in the very process of ratifying the federal constitution. The federal constitution, you'll remember, is ratified in 1787-88. It's ratified up and down a continent, and people look at this document that's been proposed by some folks at Philadelphia and say, where are the rights? And people said, oops, we forgot them. So we'll add them, and in the course of adding them, immediately after ratifying the original Constitution, we call those early rights the Bill of Rights, we the people put in a Ninth Amendment. And the Ninth Amendment, for example, says there may be some rights that aren't textualized, that aren't listed, but that they're unenumerated and yet nevertheless worthy of enforcement. They shouldn't be denied or disparaged. They shouldn't be disrespected. They shouldn't be ignored.
Is that an imperfection, or is it important that we have this unwritten constitution?
I think it's not so much an imperfection, it's more of a feature than a bug. If the constitution had to list every principle, every exception to every principle, every right, every qualification of every right, it would have been a very long and cumbersome document. It would have been like the tax code, and at that point, it wouldn't have been able to be read by ordinary people who could pretty much get the basic outline of the thing. So in a very famous case called McCulloch versus Maryland, John Marshall, writing for unanimous Supreme Court, says that the Constitution can't, in his phrase, partake of the prolixity of a legal code. It can't be long and tedious. Why not? His next sentence, it would never be understood by the public, by the people. It's a document that says we the people, that was actually voted for by ordinary citizens who could read the thing in a half hour and decide basically whether they liked the outline or not. So a basic feature of the thing is it has to be short in order to be a popular document. And if it's short, it can't list everything. So certain things we're going to have to supplement. We're going to have to read between the lines. It doesn't say separation of powers, checks and balances, the rule of law, limited government, federalism. But, of course, it implies all of those things. It says certain rights. It doesn't specify all of them. It says, for example, you can't. There's no double jeopardy. Well, obviously, there's no triple jeopardy or quadruple jeopardy. It says in the Ninth Amendment, we haven't listed all the rights.
And yet, we still look to read between those lines, and we'll often go to court to see how we can read between those lines.
And so I basically, in this new book, try to show you different ways of being faithful to the written Constitution while going beneath it, behind it, beyond it. And one of the ways that we go beneath and behind and beyond the Constitution is in our cases. We read the written Constitution through the lens, through the prism of case law. And happily, you and I and your audience, our audience, lives in a world in which basically the cases line up with the Constitution. That wasn't always so. In 1953, for example, before the Warren Court, the document said equal, but we didn't really have equal. We had apartheid. We had segregation that wasn't equal. The doctrine said free. The document said free speech, but actually free speech hadn't really prevailed. The courts hadn't protected it very vigorously. The written Constitution said that criminal defendants had various rights, but they weren't always enforced. It said that the Bill of Rights was supposed to apply against the states. Didn't use those exact words, but that was the clear purpose of the 14th Amendment adopted after the Civil War, but until the Warren Court, courts didn't really enforce that basic purpose. Happily today, there's more coherence, more alignment between the text and Supreme Court case law than there used to be. It's not perfect. The Supreme Court has gotten it wrong. It's gotten it wrong on the left sometimes. It's gotten it wrong on the right sometimes. But there's a more general alignment of the text and the cases than there used to be.
Akhil Reed Amar is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University and is the author of several books on the Constitution, including America's Constitution, a biography. And this book is a bit of a companion to that, isn't it?
Exactly. The last book took the reader through the written text, these 8,000 words, this short document, from the preamble through the articles in textual order, Article 1, the legislature, Article 2, the executive, Article 3, the judiciary, and so on, and then through the amendments, which are added chronologically, the Bill of Rights at the founding period, then after the Civil War, the Reconstruction Amendments, and then in the progressive era of the early 20th century, an income tax amendment, a woman suffrage amendment, in the 1960s, other amendments, for example, letting 18-year-olds vote. So that last book walked the reader through the text of the Constitution, and this companion volume talks about all the things that aren't in the text but that work with the text to make the text work.
What is that relationship between a written Constitution and then how do we balance venturing beyond it while being faithful to those original 8,000 words?
Exactly. So let's take what President Obama has to decide. He's got to decide, for example, whether to, at some point to recognize the Syrian rebels. Well, just as he had to decide at what point he was going to recognize the Libyan rebels. Well, where does the Constitution say that the president can recognize new regimes? It doesn't in so many words, but George Washington made a decision like that at the very beginning. He had to decide when to recognize the French revolutionaries. Obama, where does it say that he gets the power to fire a cabinet officer who's done a bad job? It doesn't say that in the text, but going all the way back to George Washington, that's been our practice. That's been our tradition. Where does it say that Daryl Issa and the members of the House of Representatives can hold oversight hearings? It doesn't say it in so many words, but Congress has always held oversight hearings. Where does it say he can hold someone in contempt if they don't show up or don't answer questions properly? There's no explicit contempt power in the words of the Constitution, but it's been part of our very process of government from the beginning. And so this book tries to show you how the strict words of the Constitution actually have to often be read not just in line with the cases, but in line with actual government practices and policies that go all the way back to the founding in many cases.
You have a chapter in this book called The Partisan Constitution, and you argue that the idea of a two-party system is embedded in the unwritten and the written constitutions. So
right.
In some cases, we're supposed to be partisan.
And at the founding, that wasn't as true. George Washington was above party, but that model collapsed very early on, and so you get parties emerging, Thomas Jefferson's party against John Adams's party, and the Constitution is actually amended, the 12th Amendment, to really legitimate this emerging two-party system. And our great presidents since Washington have been partisan presidents, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, Republicans as well as Democrats. But presidents are party leaders as well as heads of state. It's a difficult balance to be both. Some of our most important constitutional amendments were party measures. The 13th Amendment was pushed by the Republican Party. Most Democrats voted against it. The 14th Amendment, every single Democrat voted against it. Every single Republican except one in Congress voted for it. It was just a straight party line vote in the same way, say, that Obamacare was a straight party line vote. That's actually the 14th Amendment. So too, the 15th Amendment was adopted through our political party process that often sharpens issues for the voters to decide whether they're for the Abraham Lincoln's solution or the Democrat solution.
You point out in that chapter that we have gone through many eras that were much bleaker than this when it comes to polarization, but it is indeed bleak. How do we get through that?
Well, understanding that that's part of the game, and if parties are too extreme, even if they win this time around, they're not going to keep winning if they keep making that mistake. Basically, democracy has one great corrective feature built into it, a feedback loop mechanism. It's called elections. And so even if we mess up once or twice, every 2 years, every 4 years, every 6 years, we've got a chance to correct those mistakes. And so it's very messy if you look at it at any given moment, but over the long term, I think it's done pretty well. Our system is better now than it used to be. When the Constitution is adopted, almost none of the world is democratic. Today, half the world is democratic and largely on an American model of written constitutions and judicial review and rights free speech and religious tolerance. These are American ideas that now hold sway over half the planet.
And yet it can be argued that the partisan bickering that goes on has a lot to do with the fact that there is an election and all the money, all of the time, all of the talk goes into that. So the minute that we are done with this presidential election, we will start on the next cycle if we haven't started already. Is that healthy?
Well, what I can tell you is it's built into our DNA. Let's go back to the Constitution itself. So in September of 1787, 225 years ago this season, a Constitution is proposed. And Americans are very divided over it. Some people are for it. We call them the Federalists. Other people are against it. They call them the Anti-Federalists. It's a year-long raucous conversation. A lot of invective and nasty talk both ways, some, you know, by the proponents and the adversaries. They call each other all sorts of names. It's robust, uninhibited, wide-open free speech. People are burned in effigy, but no one dies. And at the end of the day, the losers basically acquiesce in the thing and the Constitution is adopted, but it doesn't end because the losers basically said, okay, even though you won this time around, you made a big mistake. You omitted all the rights. And so immediately they start tinkering with it. They're on to the next debate, which is whether there should be a Bill of Rights and what it should look like. And so it goes. But the very adoption of the Constitution, which came from the people, was divisive in a way, and it gives us a Bill of Rights. And the words "the people" appear in 5 of the first 10 amendments, the 1st, the 2nd, the 4th, the 9th, and the 10th. And that's because it came from the people, from this raucous, impolite people who like shouting and arguing with each other, but at the end of the day accepted the verdict and then came together and then worked to improve it. So that's how it works at its best. After a civil war, which, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives lost, we end up getting jewels of the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. So sometimes in America, we really have made lemonade from this lemon of disagreement. That disagreement is part of freedom.
And as you point out in the book, in the rock, paper, scissors game of democracy, it is the written Constitution that will always win out, in the sense that the unwritten Constitution will never ignore what is written.
Right. When it will help us read between the lines and resolve certain ambiguities where the Constitution is unclear. Practices help to solidify the thing. But at the end of the day, the written Constitution trumps. And when certain things, certain reforms or proposed innovations that really run against the clear text of the Constitution, those things typically don't last. They last for a season and then they collapse. The independent council law actually really didn't fit with the Constitution, and so it collapsed. There was a reform in the 20th century called the legislative veto. It really made a mockery of the words of the Constitution, and so it didn't survive. The stuff that ends up surviving long-term typically is stuff that actually coheres with the Constitution. Courts for a long time disregarded the Constitution, but then later courts came along and said, you know, it really does say equal. It really does say free speech. We have to take those principles seriously.
So when it comes to our decision on Election Day, it really does impact the future of the Constitution, doesn't it?
Oh, hugely. Even if you just focused on courts, I think that would be a mistake. But even if you just did, justices are picked by presidents and senators. And in this election, you're deciding what your Supreme Court is going to look like for the next 30 years or so. And that's only if you focus on courts, when you recognize that Congress is going to be making important decisions about health care and Social Security and women's rights and other things. And so are presidents, even stuff that doesn't always go to court. And that's what this We the People project continues, and it's really dramatic. Every 2 years, there's a House election. Every 4 years, come hell or high water, there's a presidential election. In England and other places, they postponed elections during World War II. We didn't. So every 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, we get to weigh in and possibly correct mistakes that were made the last time around.
Do you see major changes to the Constitution in 20, 50, even 100 years?
The last chapter of the book, the book is America's Unwritten Constitution, and as we've been talking about, that can mean different things, but here's one thing that an unwritten Constitution might mean. An unfinished constitution, a constitution that could be amended in the future and will be. And I try in that last chapter to imagine what the amendments might look like of the future. We talked about what happened 225 years ago. The Constitution was launched 150 years ago. This season is the Emancipation Proclamation, which is going to eventually give us the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, ending slavery and promising racial equality. So if we can look back 150 years, if we can look back 225 years, we should be able to look forward into the future and try to think about what amendments might make life better for our posterity. How could we leave a more perfect union for the generations to come? And in that last chapter, I offer a few guidelines for thinking about future amendments and what they should look like to be faithful to the constitutional project thus far.
Guidelines that are quite doable?
Well, here are the three. I say, because ours is today a two-party world, as a practical matter, the amendments are going to have to get the support of both Republicans and Democrats in order to get two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate,
right,
three-quarters of the states. Here's a second guideline. States are the laboratories of innovation and experimentation. So anything at the federal level, any new idea, is going to have to be road-tested first by the states. So we're not going to borrow some European or Asian or South American idea unless and until states do that, borrow that idea and road test it and show that it works here. And a third thought is our amendments thus far have all, with one exception, maybe prohibition, which didn't work, added to liberty and equality. They've extended the range of participation, ending slavery, black suffrage, woman suffrage, 18-year-old vote. We've added rights like free speech. We haven't cut back on rights like free speech. So I think those who want to be faithful to the story thus far should be thinking about amendments that really add to liberty and equality rather than cut back on liberty and equality.
Akhil Reed Amar is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University and periodically serves as a visiting professor at Harvard, Columbia, and Pepperdine Law Schools. The name of the new book is America's Unwritten Constitution, The Precedents and Principles We Live By. It is published by Basic Books. Akhil Reed Amar, I thank you very much for being with us and sharing your expertise.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book, America's Unwritten Constitution. It is published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.